3786. The community calendar is produced by the First Voice Apprenticeship Program. Send your listing at least 4 weeks in advance to KPFA Box 51, 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way in Berkeley, California, 94704. Or email calendar at kpfa.org. Tell us if your event is wheelchair accessible. To hear this calendar again, call 510-848-6767, extension 621. This calendar is also online at kpfa.org.
Hi, I'm Allie Budner, reporter for the Mountain West News Bureau at KRCC Radio in Colorado Springs. I'm also a graduate of the First Voice Apprenticeship Program at KPFA. The program is accepting applications for its Group 45. You can download an application at kpfaapprentice.org or call the station at 510-848-6767, extension 235.
Yes, this is KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz. Also online all the time at kpfa.org. It's 7:01. Stay tuned now for Apex Express.
Apex Express, Asian Pacific Expression.
Cultural coverage,
music and calendar,
new visions and voices,
coming to you with an Asian Pacific Islander point of view.
It's time to get on board the Apex Express.
Good evening, everyone. You're tuned into Apex Express on KPFA, bringing you an Asian and Asian American view from the Bay and around the world. We're your hosts, Miko Lee and Jelena Keenly, the Power Lee Girls, a mother-daughter team, talking tonight about sharing the knowledge. So keep it locked on Apex Express. Welcome, everyone, and happy Valentine's Day. You are on Apex Express. Tonight, we're talking about sharing the knowledge. How do we pass the words of wisdom from one generation to the next? How do we learn from the past and grow into the future and learn from our mistakes? Tonight, we're talking about the Japanese-American internment, political prisoners in the Philippines, and the start of the farm workers' rights movement.
As many of you know, February 19th, 1942 is a significant date in American history, as it was the day that FDR signed into law Executive Order 9066, which gave the U.S. government the power to incarcerate Japanese Americans in Washington, Oregon, and California during World War II. This led to the incarceration of more than 120,000 people of Japanese descent, two-thirds of whom were American citizens. To recognize that stain in our history, the Day of Remembrance was created. This Sunday marks the 40th anniversary of the Bay Area Day of Remembrance, and the community will commemorate at the Kabuki Theaters in Japantown from 2 to 4 p.m. We welcome to the studio Jeff Matsuka, chair of the Day of Remembrance Organizing Committee, and Ben Takashita, who just last year was awarded the Clifford I. Yuda Peace and Humanitarian Award. Welcome, gentlemen. First off, Jeff, can you tell us about the Bay Area Day of Remembrance?
Sure. Yes, as you say, we're celebrating our 40th anniversary of the Bay Area Day of Remembrance. It's going to be this coming Sunday, February 17th from 2 to 4 at the Kabuki 8 Theater in Japantown. And really, the Day of Remembrance, as you mentioned, is kind of our community's way of remembering, trying to remember the history, basically, of Executive Order 9066, which had such a profound impact on our JA community. And it's to celebrate the past, but also to try to go forward with lessons, basically, so that these terrible things that happened to our community won't happen to any other community here in the United States.
And Ben, can you tell us and our listeners about your connection to the internment?
Yes. I was 11 at the time the World War II started, and we were living in San Mateo. And so when our date came, May 19th, 1942, we were sent to San Bruno to Tamfran racetracks. And from there, in September of 1942, we were transferred to Topaz, Utah, and then the loyalty questionnaire thing came up in the spring of 1943. So as a result of my older brother's responses, no to as a protest against incarcerating American citizens, we all went to our family was transferred to Tule Lake in Northern California. And so that's my history in terms of being in the three camps during that period.
And can you tell us more about the loyalty questionnaire?
Yes, I would love to. But, you know, in the 1930s, many of the, because of a lot of discrimination in, for amongst Japanese and being for Japanese and so on, my parents, like many of the Japanese families of that time, sent their daughters and sons to Japan to learn the Japanese language so that they could maybe get a good, better job working for a Japanese company. Of course, not knowing that several years later we'll be in at war with Japan. But when 1934 came, my mother took five of us to Japan and left my two older brothers there. And while my two brothers were there, Japan was at war with China, and they tried to recruit many of the young people to join the Japanese army. And my brothers, as well as the others who were being educated in Japan, refused, and by saying they are American citizens, therefore we will not join the Japanese army. Mm-hmm. And they weren't put in jail. Then the Japanese government said, oh, okay, then we'll respect that. But when Pearl Harbor came about and Executive Order 9066 was passed, our own government did not respect that citizenship and put all of us, 120,000 of us, into camps, regardless of citizenship, and no hearing, no court sessions or anything. So that's why when the loyalty questionnaire came out in the spring of 1942-43, my brother fought very hard to try to convince people to vote no on the questionnaire. I have the questions that talked to, but wanted them to vote no, answer no to those two loyalty questions as a form of protest. And I have a written document, an FBI report, that tells me that my brother had a record because of his activities in Topaz trying to convince people to vote no as a part of the protest. But on that document that the FBI wrote, they put down that my brother did not want to go to Japan, but his actions were done as a form of protest for what the U.S. government did to American citizens of that time. So I have proof that and the reason why he was very active in the no-no. And to this day, many of the Japanese-American community and many of the veterans who were fought in 442 feel they will not excuse the people who voted or answered no-no to the loyalty questionnaires because they thought that they were afraid to die and then think in terms of the protest element. Wayne Collins, one of the lawyers from San Francisco that helped to the Japanese Americans during that period and when they renounced their citizenship and so on, his son says that one of the heroes of that period were the people who voted no-no as a form of protest for what the U.S. government did.
And I think for many of us in the Asian American progressive community, the no-no boys have held up as strong activists that are fighting for civil rights and have been there for a long time. So we applaud them for their legacy, and we look up to them as models for what can happen right now. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering with your past having been incarcerated, what you think about what's happening right now to Muslim kids and kids that are on the borders right now between our southern border and the United States, and what are your feelings about that and how that translates?
Well, you know, the executive order that President Reagan signed to apologize to us and so on, that is still on the books. And so, and then some of the recent politicians are saying that they want to use the our Japanese American experience as a form of samplings so that they could incarcerate other people. So That's why I'm so active in it, because I felt that even though it's 75 years ago, then we haven't still learned how to do this. So on Thursdays from 2 p.m. at the Richmond Rosie the Riveter Museum, Flora Nenomia, cut flower person, and myself go on. In fact, this afternoon I was on the show to talk about my World War II experience, to let them know that we can't allow this kind of thing to happen again, and we want to make sure that as many people as possible know about this dark side of our U.S. history.
And Jeff, can you talk about your connection to the internment and how you got involved with the Day of Remembrance?
Yes, well, it turns out that my mother's family were actually Peruvian Japanese. They were actually born and raised. Actually, my mother was born in Lima, Peru. But there actually were quite a few Japanese immigrants who moved from Japan to South America in the early 20th century, to Brazil and in Peru in particular. And my grandfather, who originally was from Kumamoto in Japan, he immigrated to Peru in the early 20th century. And, you know, he eventually was able to start a very prosperous dry cleaning business in Lima, Peru. And, of course, the Japanese Peruvian community in Lima was quite prosperous. But when after Pearl Harbor, through some kind of... I suppose it was, even though Peru was a neutral country, they must have, apparently the United States was actually querying sort of other South American countries to see whether or not they would actually be able to deport Japanese, citizens of Japanese ancestry to the United States. Potentially, we've heard for prisoner exchanges for United States citizens who are held by the Japanese forces in either Japan or in the Pacific Islands. So what happened, amazingly enough, and my mother, who at that time was a teenager, basically, she was about 13 years old, she said one day, she said the police, the Peruvian police, along with FBI agents, actually came to their house looking for my grandfather, basically, who wasn't there. And, you know, what eventually happened was they arrested, basically, you know, him, and eventually, of course, the family wanted to join him. So they actually deported my whole family, along with a few other. They didn't deport everybody, but they were actually looking for community leaders, as they did here, also here in the United States. You know, church community, Japanese language teachers, you know, judo teachers, people who they identified basically as potentially influenced by the Japanese ideology. So
cultural leaders.
Cultural leaders, that's correct. Or community leaders as well. Business people like my grandfather, for instance. So amazingly enough, the United States actually deported through Peru, you know, my mother's family all the way through Crystal City, Texas. That's where they spent the war, actually, at the DOJ, or Department of Justice camp at Crystal City, Texas, which is a very... It's actually different from the WRA camps, basically. These are actually run by the DOJ itself. And they're actually also prisoners of war, interestingly enough, at these camps as well. There are German prisoner of wars also at the camp. So, you know, it's a unique story, and it's probably little known. But once again, it goes to tell you the reach, basically, you know, of the United States government as far as what it could do in times of wartime hysteria. And we kind of see the same thing again, as you might see. For instance, you all have to look at Guantanamo Bay is a good example, rendition, basically, of people, basically, without any kind of due process at all.
Your family's story is one that is really often not told. I mean, not that many people know about the internment, but even more don't know about the internment of the South American Japanese. Last year, we interviewed the Shibayama brothers and their lawsuit. They were a family that was taken out in the middle of the night from Panama, along with many others, and also put in Crystal City, which was considered the harshest of the internment centers. And they also did not, all of the South American Japanese did not receive any kind of compensation or any kind of apology, because they were not United States citizens, and they had no country to return to after the war. And the Shibayama family has been fighting this in world court and as a human rights violation. So that, thank you for sharing that story about, and in that case, that was about the Panama Canal. It was a back deal, government, middle of the night kind of deal to make sure that America could still get the Panama Canal passed through. So, I'm wondering what you hope the Day of Remembrance does, given our current political climate. What is your hope for it from both of you?
Well, you know, of course, the Day of Remembrance for our community is to remember, basically, the lessons of the past and to also share our experience, basically, with the greater American community. As you mentioned, I really don't think, unfortunately, outside of perhaps both coasts, very many Americans even realized what happened to our community during the war. And so that's certainly one goal. But the other goal, of course, is to learn from what we have gone through so that, you know, what we went through, as we say, should never again happen to any other community.
In terms of what the Day of Remembrance means to me anyway, is that after even 75 years that we're still hearing things about reincarcerating people and so on. So that's why I am very active in this. But I want to divert a little bit in that when we went to Tula Lake as a family, we were told that we would be exchanged for prisoners of war that Japan had of U.S. citizens. And so then my brother, who was a Kibei, educated in Japan, he and some others who are bilingual started a Japanese language school. And in that language school, then we learned how to speak Japanese and so on. But the rumors were that we will be sent back to Japan as an exchange. And so we fought very hard to do it. And then and during the one-year anniversary of the school, we had a track and field event in Tula Lake. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, we were surrounded by jeeps with MPs, military police, with rifles, and they took my brother, who was one of the instructors, one of the students away. The student was returned the same day, but my brother, they kept him for over a month. And when he came back, he was not the same person that I felt he was, a gung-ho person. But many years later, during the Korean War, is when I really asked him what happened to him, because I couldn't ask him at that time. That he did return. And he told me that they questioned him a lot about his activities in Topaz, trying to get people to answer the loyalty questionnaires in the negative. And after that, they brought him out and put him against the wall, and he saw military police with rifles standing in front of him. They asked him if he wanted a cigarette. He said no. They gave him a blindfold, so he put the blindfold on. And they even went as far to go ready, aim, fire. Well, he thought that was the end of his life. But it turned out that they had no bullets in there, so all he could hear were click, click, click sounds. And I thought my brother was the only one that experienced that kind of torture, so to speak. But it turned out that when I was in several years ago, when I went on a Tula Lake pilgrimage, there was a group from Tula Lake as a group who were lined up against the wall and had the same thing, were ready aim fire with no bullets in there. So this is the kind of thing that was prevalent throughout our 3.5 years of confinement, is these kinds of things to keep us in line with it. I know in Topaz, I remember this man who was about 55 years old. He was picking seashells, and he was concentrating on picking seashells, because if he presses it and it breaks, then he won't keep it. But if it didn't break, then we would save it for the ladies to make trinkets out of. And he was doing that when one of the guards said, "Go back, you're too close to the wall fence." And he obviously didn't hear, and so the guard just shot him dead without any reason other than to being close to the gate, which was out in the middle of nowhere anyway. And this same truck driver in Tule Lake who was taking farm workers out to the farm site and then back. And he was shot because he came back and the guard won't let him go in. So he got out of his truck and went towards the guard to try to find out what was the matter. And the guard got scared and just point blank shot him dead. And so these are, as I said, the kinds of things that we are overwhelmingly facing all the time to make sure that we kept in order, so to speak. So a lot of people don't hear about these kinds of incidences. But I try to make sure that people realize that's the kind of threat that punishment or the treatment we received throughout our 3.5 years of confinement.
And thank you so much for sharing that story with us and all of our listeners. And yes, that very well fits our theme of sharing the knowledge tonight. And we're so grateful for the work that both of you are doing to bring about this day of remembrance and make sure that this is not something that is forgotten or repeated in our country.
And one more time, the dates and time of the Day of Remembrance.
Right, the Day of Remembrance will take place this coming Sunday, February 17th from 2 to 4 p.m. at the AMC Kabuki 8 Theater in Japantown. That's at 1881 Post Street. We have $8 suggested donation, and all are welcome. We're also going to have a reception at the Japanese Community and Cultural Center of Northern California from 4 to 6.
Thank you both so much for joining us, and we'll have all the links on our website about how you can attend the Day of Remembrance. Next up, take a listen to Passion Fruit by Yeji. To APEC Express on KPFA. That was Yeji's Passion Fruit. Next up, we hear an update from the Philippines by Bayan, USA. We kick off 1 Billion Rising to end violence against women and children on February 14th and talk about the fight to free all political prisoners. Did you know 10% of the 540 political prisoners in the Philippines are women? Let's hear from Bayan, USA.
Every February 14th marks an international mobilization for women across the world. 1 Billion Rising, a global campaign to raise awareness and demand a stop to violence against women and children. Women human rights defenders, workers, students, urban poor, indigenous peoples, and individuals from different organizations and institutions gather to denounce violence against women and to show solidarity throughout the world. In the Philippines, hundreds of women, children, and allies take to the streets and hold programs across the various provinces in the 7,000 islands. Jom Salvador, Secretary General of Gabriela, said, "Abuse and violence on women does not stop inside their homes. More intense forms of violence are sponsored and perpetuated by the state. We have witnessed in the last 2 years of the Duterte regime an accelerating increase in poverty and state-instigated violence. Each day, we hear and see women and children being victims of extrajudicial killings since the start of Oplan Tokhang, or better known as the drug war." End quote. At the beginning of the year, the House and Senate approved of a bill that would lower the minimum age of criminal responsibility from 15 years old to 12 years old, with the House originally passing their bill to lower the age to 9 years old, but amended this due to protests and pressure from the public and advocacy groups. Congress has yet to fail or pass this measure, which will resume session post-midterm elections in May. Philippine jails have become increasingly packed under Duterte's drug war, combined with the arrests of political activists and human rights defenders, ranking among the most overcrowded prisons in the world. On January 15th, there was one victory for the people: the recent release of National Democratic Front peace consultant Rafael Bailosis, nearly a year after his illegal arrest. The court dismissed the false charges, ruling that the search and arrest conducted by the police were illegal in the first place. However, NDFP consultant and Philippine Peace Center Executive Director Ray Casambre and his wife Cora are still detained, along with the 540 other political prisoners. 203 were arrested under President Duterte. This week, on February 10th, an alert was released by the rural missionaries of the Philippines and human rights workers initiating a fact-finding and rescue efforts for the release of two human rights advocates, Gloria Jandayan and Glaceria Balangyao, mother and daughter, being detained at the 1st Special Forces Battalion camp in Manolo Fortrich Town, Mindanao. Their arrest adds to the long list of cases of human rights violations against Gabriela Women's Party List and Makabayan volunteers on the eve of the electoral campaign period before the midterm elections, which will result in heightened attacks against human rights defenders. They have yet to be released. Nearly 10% of political prisoners are women. 1 Billion Rising's call is to rise, resist, and unite. Gabriela USA's adaptation is to rise against Duterte, resist militarization, and unite for genuine liberation. Join Gabriela Oakland today at their Love Letters for Liberation event to create letters of love and support for women, trans, and gender nonconforming people in prison. 6 to 9 p.m. at 7th West, 1255 7th Street, Oakland. For more information on this event and the upcoming International Working Women's Day March, follow at Gabriela Oakland on Facebook and Instagram. A national summit for human rights and democracy in the Philippines will be held on April 5 through 7 in Washington, D.C., to gather Filipinos and allies across the U.S. to unite on ways to collaborate in building the broadest movement against Duterte's fascism until he is forced to step down. For more information on this event, visit malayamovement.com. This has been Updates from the Philippines by Bayan USA. On the web, go to bayanusa.org.
This is Apex Express on KPFA. You just heard from Jessica Antonio of Bayan USA, an alliance of 26 progressive Filipino organizations in the U.S. representing students, scholars, women, workers, artists, and youth. As the first and largest international chapter of Bagong Alisang Makabayan. Bayan serves as an information bureau for the National Democratic Movement of the Philippines. And as a center for educating, organizing, and mobilizing anti-imperialist and progressive Filipinos in the U.S. For more details, check out BayanUSA.org.
Oh, so sorry about the laughter. Well, it's Valentine's Day and we're a little punchy in the studio. Welcome author Gail Ramasanta, who with the late great Don Mabalan wrote the children's book Journey for Justice about the life of farm worker activist Larry Itliong. Welcome, Gail.
Hi, happy to be here. What is funny?
Oh,
I want to find out.
No, nothing is funny. We are just horribly massacring names. It is just crazy.
Okay.
We're so bad with the pronunciations. And I, of all people, when people always mispronounce my name, I'm horrible at that. Apologies. So,
well, she always instigates the laughter and then plays it off as if she's not laughing.
Yes, it's anyways.
Oh, okay.
So apologies to Jessica Antonio, who did a really strong piece about a really important thing, which is the whole movement of women and the Billion Rising movement. And we support her, and that had nothing to do with her. It was totally my giggle. So, Gail, yay, Journey for Justice, about the life of Larry Itliong, an amazing hero in the world and specifically in the APA community. Tell us what inspired you and, of course, Dawn to create this book to recognize Larry.
Gosh, you know, I have to say that the universe was there helping us. I mean, I had an idea. I was pregnant with twins at the time, and I really wanted to do a children's book about Larry Itliong. My kids would be coming home, and they would have papers, and it would say, you know, ask them to do a report on a famous person, and that list wouldn't have anybody that my child or the children in my family, you know, that they could look at and resemble or understand or have relevance with for them in their minds. And so I Googled Larry Itliong. There was nothing about him. There was no book about him on Amazon or anywhere. And there was definitely no children's book about Filipino-American heroes, specifically nonfiction ones. And so I called Dawn up and I said, hey, listen, we need to do a children's book about Larry Itliong. And she said, yes. She was writing her college-aged full biography at the time about Larry Itliong. And so it was perfect. She was doing that. And we were working on the children's book. So the children's book would be done first, and then it would be a perfect segue into her college-age full biography about Larry.
And so for those few people in the audience that might not know who he is, can you just give a brief synopsis about why he is an important part of the labor movement in America?
Larry Itliong was the leader for the Filipinos who went on strike. They voted September 7th, 1965 in Filipino Hall. We were just there celebrating over the weekend. And he is the one that called Cesar Chavez and asked him and the Mexicans to join on this strike. And usually they were not together. They were not in solidarity. The two groups were not in solidarity with one another. So this was historic. Cesar had, he wasn't sure. He wasn't sure if they were ready. They didn't have capacity. And he eventually said, yes, we're going to join you. And that is when the two came together. They ultimately joined the UFW. And Cesar Chavez became the director. And Larry Itliong became assistant director. And all of these years, Larry Itliong passed away in 1977 on February 8th, this past Friday. And no book has been written about him. And he is been pretty much erased from history.
And as many people know, he was really the one of the leaders behind the farm workers' grape boycott. And we last year interviewed Dolores Huerta, and she said, oh yes, he really had strong ideas. He was just right.
Yeah.
And I loved it. She just, when we asked her questions about Larry, her eyes just sort of lit up as she remembered him as such a fierce character. Can you talk a little bit about his character? Because he kind of, you know, Just describe him for our audience. What did he look like? How did he carry himself?
Well, many people actually would laugh when they heard Don and I were writing a children's book. They would say, "I don't know how you're going to get him in a children's book." And his character was that he was absolutely determined and he was absolutely ready to do anything for his people. He, in order to get to the United States, he had an argument with his father. This is in the book, because his father didn't want him to go. And his father said, "No, I don't give you permission." And he says, "I'm going anyway. I'm going to the United States." And he goes. And how he goes is because he gambles. He gambles and he gets money to buy his passage on the Empress of Asia. And he gets here and he sees the injustices, that are happening to people, to Filipinos, wherever he goes, humiliated and being paid nothing. We were in Delano and everyone was saying that, really indentured servitude that they felt was going on with them and, their families. And a neat little thing, Dolores Huerta's son, Emilio, came by at our lunch for Dr. Don Mabalon. If you all don't know, she passed this last August, and on August 10th, we celebrated this past Sunday in Delano her 6-month death anniversary, and Emilio Huerta came by. He wanted to see if the book was right. He wanted to see if if we were right in our facts. And he said, "You guys were right. You got this information correct. Larry did meet my mom before he met Caesar."
He was fact checking the book after it had been published.
He did. He wanted to make sure. We had actually gone to Don had actually gone to La Paz. She had gone to the headquarters of UFW. We had gotten our approvals there for the images that were going into the book. This book was completely vetted by historians, journalists that were covering the grape strike at the time, librarians, children's librarians, children, scholars. So, this was read so many times by many different people, but it was so nice that Emilio came in and he read it and he was like, "Okay, you guys did a great job."
And we heard that Larry was nicknamed Seven Fingers. Can you tell us how that came to be?
Yes. He was on a train and he was attempting to jump off. And when he jumped off, he caught his hand and it ripped those fingers right off. And he had gotten it, he had gotten it fixed. And his father had written him a letter and said, "Come back home. We want you home." And he said, "Nope, I'm going to stay here even though I have seven fingers.
Wow.
And I'm going to still continue on doing what I'm doing."
And why do you think Larry's story is so important now? And I'm also curious about your practice as an artist and how you use your art to kind of rewrite history or add to history some people that have been forgotten by mainstream culture.
I think it's so important because so many of our communities, marginalized communities, don't get their stories told. We're forgotten and put on the wayside. We're looked at as insignificant and not contributing to American society or history. We're not worth the time, the investment, the money to be talked about, to be written about, to have our kids learn about us. And so when we bring this story and we're going on a nationwide tour, we kicked it off in Delano. We had a Congressman T.J. Cox there. We had assembly members there, Rudy Salas from District 21 in Delano. And we also had Rob Bonta's mom, Cynthia Bonta, there. And Rob Bonta, who is Alameda County Assembly, California Assembly member, he did a video. So when we heard and we saw the mainstream coming and listening to Larry's story, we all cried. We have been silenced. And, this is not just our story, but so many of our communities that who do not have a voice, but we have been silenced. And we are doing this as a movement throughout the country. We are visiting the leading universities in the United States. We have a teacher's guide that was created by Dr. Tintianko Cabales and her team Eileen Pagtasong, Aldrich Sabak, and Daisy Lopez. That was the team that created the Teacher's Guide, which is so beautiful. You can find the link at www.bridgedelta.com. So we're teaching. In addition, this is not just a book. We are teaching, and we're institutionalizing this history without any permission from anybody. No one wanted to talk about this, and no one wanted to write a book or publish this book, or, you know, mainstream never asked for it. And Filipinos didn't ask for it either. And so when we started on this, we decided we're going to DIY. We're going to do it yourself. We don't need permission from anybody to do this. And so that's how we're going into this national book tour.
I have to say, I was really impressed. I had a chance to look over the curriculum, and being somebody that in my daytime job, I also work with teaching artists, and being able to see how much thought and care and knowledge there is in the study guide, the curriculum is great. And I'm wondering how much mm-hmm. you're working with the California Counter Narratives Project, which is all about telling alternative histories. And this is like a perfect fit into that. Are you working with that project at all through the state of California?
No, we're not. I would love to be part of it.
Okay, I will follow up with you on that one later.
Well, one of my favorite...
Send me the... Uh-huh.
Oh, I was just going to say, one of my favorite things about Larry's story is how it really shows this idea of intersectionality way before the phrase was even coined or was like a very popularized idea. So I'm curious your thoughts about making this kind of information and histories available, particularly to young activists, so that they know that, you know, these concepts have been put into practice a long time ago before these were kind of like the things that we were talking about.
Right. And that's what's so cool about history. And, you know, hopefully the kids who are reading this, you know, the youth that are reading this, it's actually all ages book and all ages teacher's guide, but so that they notice that history repeats itself. I mean, we can just take a look at the climate right now and the leadership of our country. Many things are being repeated, and we do all need to intersect again. I think at least I know the Filipino American community has not fought other communities and have been in solidarity with them. I know a few pockets, but the general mainstream have not. So, I mean, if we're talking about intersectionality, then I think this is a perfect time to relearn that again. If this is alien to other parts of the country, you know, maybe in certain pockets, we definitely understand it. And, you know, there are activists to support this and to talk about it. But in places where we're going, this may not be a known term. And the only thing that they can grasp onto is this, the historical fact and the memory of Larry Itliong and what he did.
Thank you so much, Gail.
I hope I answered that question.
You did. You did a great job answering that question. We're talking tonight about sharing the knowledge, and you're taking it home by sharing that knowledge with the community. Folks can find out more about the book on the KPFA website, our Apex Express section. And we want to thank you, Gail, for your time and your amazing work and the great book, Journey for Justice, The Life of Larry Itliong. Thank you so much, Gail. We're going to take
Thank
a
you
listen.
For having me.
Yes, we loved hearing from you. We're going to take a listen to Anxiety by Trace.
Seen it all around my anxiety.
We are back, and you're tuned to Apex Express on KPFA. That was Anxiety by Trace, and thank you to Ayame for our music curation. We're going to flip-flop things and do the community calendar first before Jalene and I do our chat fest. Our first guest, we're talking about the Bay Area Day of Remembrance. It's happening both on February 17th from 2 to 4 at the Kabuki Theater in Japantown, San Francisco, and there's also one happening down in San Jose. The With Her Voice, She Rises, a celebration of API women in performance and literature, is March 8th and 9th at Bindlestiff Studio. Passionate Engagement, The Art of Nancy Hom, a month-long exhibition and celebration of Nancy's legacy of art and activism in the Bay Area, is going on. And Love Letters for Liberation, we talked about that too. That's actually happening tonight from 6 until 9 o'clock. And this is to create letters of love and support for women, trans, and gender nonconforming people in prisons. That's happening tonight in Oakland. And the National Summit for Human Rights and Democracy in the Philippines from April 5th to 7th in Washington, D.C., where Filipinos and allies across the U.S. are going to unite on ways to collaborate on building the broadest movement against Duterte's fascism. So that's the calendar, and now it's going to be just me and Jalene chatting about what's happening in the news.
I think as a lot of those events illustrate, it is a great time to be an Asian American artist, especially now that there's more focus, or perhaps focus for the first time ever, on Asian American art. So it's great to see all these different community things happening, and then also seeing it on a larger scale with, of course, Crazy Rich Asians and our favorite Sandra Oh.
Sandra Oh, for those of you who don't know, was the first Asian American person, or Asian person, right, to win a Golden Globe for Best Lead in a Drama for Killing Eve. And she also was the host of the Golden Globes. And during that, to me, the most amazing thing was that she stood up and said, "I love you," to her parents in Korean and bowed to them. And I have to say, I watched it, and like a sap, I cried.
No, and I love because her parents look like semi-impressed.
No, I didn't think they looked impressed at all, actually.
They're like, "Oh, cool."
I didn't think they looked impressed. Actually, it reminded me, I don't know if you saw that thing of Michelle Obama's mom. Did you see that at the Grammys? Michelle Obama posted posted this exchange she had with her mom, who seems like so down to earth and actually very much like a stereotypical Asian mom, like totally unimpressed with her kid. And she basically posted this thing saying, "You know, did you see me on the Grammys?" And she said, "Oh yeah, I saw you. What were you doing with all those famous people?" Or something to that effect, which I just loved. And to me, that was the kind of look that Sandra Oh's parents gave her. Although I love that she recognized them in Korean and bowed at them. That, to me, was just such a... I was shocked that I was so emotional about that.
And it seems like there's more and more projects being greenlit that have all Asian casts or featuring Asian leads, which is really wonderful, and a lot more people coming up in the industry. I know there's that new Yara Shahidi movie,
right,
which stars an Asian male lead, a hot Asian male lead, who's also in Riverdale, who's also in a recent Ariana Grande album, and is quickly becoming one of the teen heartthrobs. So it's really wonderful to have that as a young Asian man and to really see Asian men on the come up in mainstream media right now.
And Asian men seen as sexy and appealing, not just as kind of buffoons.
Yeah, and I just came back from Sundance, where I saw Lulu Wang's The Farewell, which was a phenomenal movie starring Awkwafina. And it's an adaptation of her This American Life, I guess, story, like radio show. It wasn't the whole show, but segment. And it's all about dealing with pain and illness in a Chinese family and all the ways that we suppress our emotions or defer our emotions for the good of our other family members. And it was really great and such a tearjerker.
So it's Lulu Wang. It's her story that she did on This American Life that she then wrote and directed as a movie?
Yes.
Cool. And Awkwafina in a serious role. How was she?
She was phenomenal. I was really, really impressed with her.
Wow, that's pretty amazing because, she has, as a rapper and as a kind of comic-y, clownish figure, but as a serious actor, I didn't know that she could do that. That's
great. I think this is actually not her first serious role. She's had a few, but they just haven't been, they haven't gone as far, the films, as like Crazy Rich Asians or other things like that. And then she's also working on an original TV show.
I really like how not just for API people, but for a lot of different people of color are being empowered right now to tell their stories and people are paying attention to it. And that feels very different. I thought it was interesting, back to Sandra Oh, when she was really seriously looked out at the audience and said, this is a really amazing time to be in. And she thanked people. And people at first started laughing because they thought she was making a joke. But she was really being honest. Did you catch that part?
I don't remember that part.
Yeah, she was just really looking at them saying, you know, we're living in an amazing time and that's why I'm up here. And there's this titter from the audience, like they're going, ah, they thought she was telling
a joke.
Well,
that's because they're all white guys that have been replaced by the Me Too movement that feel scared. But I think it's a great time for us.
Well, I think it's, I mean, yes, but a lot of those people that are in power positions see that too, because I was reading this, John Chu just had this whole new thing that he's doing called the Gold Open with AMC, and they're putting money very specifically into Asian American folks coming up and showing to movie theaters. And so I just think they're seeing that there's money to be earned, and so that also helps, you know,
yes,
push
capitalism.
Yes, capitalism at work. Yeah, that's really interesting. Okay, the other thing in the news is this whole study that just came out about looking at a gender gap in education for Asian Americans. And what they found is, well, we know that on the scale of test scores and school junks, Asian Americans do better than any other race, right? That's just test score wise. That's a thing.
Yeah, so, when Asian Americans are not disaggregated.
Right, exactly. And what they found was that when you break it down further by gender, with the traditional construct of boy and girl, then they found that boys and girls do absolutely the same level of really high achieving until adolescence, and then girls zoom ahead and boys scale back.
So, I thought it would be the girls that were killing it.
The girls that were doing well. So, and you know, I work with a lot of educators and they joke about how most Western American, you know, basic education is created for, you know, Chinese, and I do say Chinese intentionally, girls. At Lowell High School in San Francisco, they call that the Chinese girls' school. Because it's, you know, you sit.
You have to test to get into it.
You have to test to get it. You sit at a desk. You pay attention. You follow directions.
Although that's reinforcing a lot of negative stereotypes about what it means to be an Asian American woman.
Oh, totally. I am just saying that. So now what do you think about these theories about why this gender gap exists? Why girls excel after adolescence and boys fall back? What do you think that's about?
Well, I'd be curious to see disaggregated data on that, because I know a lot of Asian American populations, the boys are targeted to enter things like gangs, have other like things that are pulling them out of school. Maybe not in the communities that we think of that are like going to Harvard and doing all these like suing Harvard for not letting them in and stuff like that. But if we're thinking about Asian Americans as an entire population, there are a lot of populations that are that have really high rates of being low income and being at risk for things that pull you out of school, that make it so that school can't be your main focus. And we know that a lot of times those risks target young boys more than they target young girls.
And people are talking, I mean, they're doing more research on this because this just came out, but they're really looking at that in terms of how it correlates to toxic masculinity, that boys are actually not seen as wanting to excel. It's better if you're cool and you're not doing well in school across all
ethnicity. Which is interesting because my mom made me go to an all-girls middle school for the exact opposite reason, which was her theory that American girls try to be hot in middle school instead of being smart.
American girls. I would never use that phrase, American girls. Never.
Well, girls in the U.S., how else would you say it?
Yes, of any ethnicity. Yes.
Yeah, American means any ethnicity.
So you did go to an single-sex middle school and college, and the college one you got to choose on your own. Why did you do that?
Well, you know, they gave me the most money. Thank you, Wellesley College.
But is there another reason? Do you feel like that benefited you, the single-sex education?
Yeah, it did benefit me, but I chose it because it gave me the best financial aid, which I think is the driving force of a lot of college decisions. But it was a really great experience, and I think that's also why I don't know why boys might be having this, you know, learning gap to fall back, because
you don't get it.
What are boys?
You don't get it. So you mentioned this briefly before, the whole thing about Harvard, and now apparently there's a bump in the road in that lawsuit that those Asian Americans that are being used by white supremacists to sue Harvard for affirmative action.
And okay, but they're still doing it, so I think it's not really fair to be like, oh, they're being used. That white girl, Abigail, who is the suit in like UT Austin or whatever, that she was being used too, but it's like we didn't give her that accommodation of like, oh, she's being used. It was like, no, this crazy girl,
I think,
is
people were saying she was being used too, and she's being used by the exact same people. It's the exact same people filing this lawsuit.
Yeah, they're being used, but also they know who it is that's funding their lawsuit. They could easily do research and figure out what's going on.
Yeah, that's for sure. But I do have to say, at the same time that that's going on across the country, API people are fighting for ethnic studies, both at high school level and at colleges. There's like four different colleges that are fighting for ethnic studies, and particularly Asian American studies, to tell their part of the American history and to share stories like we were talking about tonight. So they learn about people at high school like Larry Itliong, or about the Japanese internment, or the Japanese South Americans that are interned, that's even less known. So I do think that is good news, that there are young folks. So there's a whole bunch of high school students at, I think it's in Irvine, that are fighting so that at their high school they could have Asian studies.
Yay! That's so great. And good for them.
And there's actually an online petition that you can sign. I signed it because I thought, well, good
and
for
we'll
you,
link
young
it
people.
In our show notes.
Yes, we can do a link for that. You're laughing because one of the other little things that I had down here was Asians for pot, Asians against pot.
Well, we have a one-to-one right here in this room.
Oh, I don't care if other people want to do pot. I'm just saying, for me personally, it's not good for my body. But there's this whole movement with an Asian Americans for cannabis movement. And then there's a whole nother one of older folks in the LA Times that are absolutely against pot. So I just thought that was fascinating. And what's your final thoughts before we do a wrap up?
Well, actually, it's about the Harvard thing. I think all of the stuff around affirmative action has kind of cracked open the application process in general, and they've actually found a lot of racial bias against Asian Americans throughout the application process. So I think it's an ongoing thing that can definitely be worked on and something that our community looks into.
And as we've talked about before, the killer about application process is it's those legacy folks that get in. That's the biggest amount of folks that get in. So that's really the issue. But tonight we're talking about sharing the knowledge. We thank you so much for joining us here on Apex Express. We thank our guests for being with us and all of you listeners. Keep resisting, keep organizing, keep creating and sharing your visions with the world, because your voices are important. Apex Express is produced by Marie Che, Tara Darabji, Salima Hamarani, Preeti Mangalashekar, Lindsay Ota, Natasha Hardin, Eunice Kwan, Miko Lee, and Jelena Keen Lee. And tonight's show was produced by us, with music curated by Ayame Keen Lee. Thanks to Franklin and the Apprentices for your support.